From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Before Victorine Q. Adams was elected the first African-American woman on the Baltimore City Council in 1967, she was a teacher. Then she poured her energies into political education, like the Colored Women's Democratic Campaign Committee and other grassroots organizing. Morgan State archivist Ida E. Jones' book tells how Victorine and her husband, the notable numbers runner Little Willie Adams, shared political goals. But Victorine insisted voters were drawn by her own hard work, like her push for job training.
The poverty that was happening in the city as McCormick Spice left, as the shipyards closed, as these kinds of manufacturing and manual jobs left the city, you impoverished a generation of working, able-bodied people who were not transitioning or being transitioned to the new jobs that were coming.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. 52 years ago, Baltimore had not seen an African-American woman on its city council. Victorine Q. Adams was elected in 1967, leaving a seat in the state legislature to run. That only begins to describe her achievements and impact. When Victorine Adams died in 2006, no less a political icon than Senator Barbara Mikulski told mourners that she had learned from Adams how to get things done. Author Ida E. Jones lays out the context and dynamics behind Adams' story in her book, Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorine Q. Adams, The Power of the Ballot. Jones is university archivist in the Earl S. Richardson Library at Morgan State University. We're revisiting a conversation with her from May. I started by asking what we should know about Victorine Q. Adams.
I think they should know about the humanity and the compassion she had for her fellow man, and that there was an era in politics when people actually did care about their constituency. So it does let us know that there's hope for politicians.
That's a lot. How did you come to write this book?
As university archivist at Morgan State, there are a number of collections there. And every day I go into work and there's a cacophony of voices. Tell my story, tell my story. So she was one of the earlier voices that spoke loud to me because I share an organizational affiliation with her and had not even heard of her.
Organizational affiliation?
Yeah, we share a sorority. Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated. We're both members of that organization. I've been one for 25 plus years. She passed away during my tenure. So I really felt a need to personally investigate her in light of our centennial that will be coming up in 2022.
So she was born Victorine Quill in West Baltimore in 1912. Tell us about her parents.
Her mother was a migrant or immigrant from Virginia, and her father came from the Eastern Shore, and they met in Baltimore in, I want to say, fall of 1911. He did day laboring and other kinds of activities, and the mother was domestic in terms of doing short kinds of activities. She was born in the spring of 1912, and I'm not a big mathematician, but we might just say she might have been a love child. But nevertheless, most black persons who had very limited education did what they could to provide for their family. So she was raised in a very loving household of parents who were very industrious and stayed employed and kept their family flush with cash to survive.
She went to public schools in Baltimore, including Douglas High School. You described the physical conditions there as deplorable at the time.
Yes. What I've come to realize in the research and just doing the work at Morgan is that African-American women, principally school teachers, for the first half of the 20th century in Baltimore, were very instrumental in being the civil rights vanguard. These women really understood what they were doing in terms of the reach they could have, as well as the foundation they established for their students. So they fight for equitizing pay. They fight for the best environment for their children because there were sick buildings. I mean, the idea of mortar and other things falling off of the ceiling or mold, other kinds of environmental hazards that would shut schools down in this contemporary time. Black students were forced to deal with those circumstances then.
Victorine Quill went to the two-year program at what was then Coppin Normal School to become a teacher. She became a teacher. She continued to study for a Bachelor of Science in Education at Morgan State. So was she teaching the whole time she was at Morgan State?
She was. She was actually employed. And there's a picture, I think, in the book of her at a tender age of 18 or 19 years old in an elementary school classroom. She was very petite and the children were up to her shoulder. But it's a very nice portrait of a classroom. So you get to see how they were learning, the lunch they had in the classroom. You get a lot of dimension.
That's Morgan State archivist Ida B. Jones, author of the biography Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorine Q. Adams. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. When I first heard about your book, I was determined not to describe Victorine Quill Adams in relation to her husband. I thought, I'm a liberated woman. I'm not going to define her that way. But as I read, I realized that Willie Adams is a big part of the story. Who was William L. Adams?
There's multiple images and ideas of who William Adams was. To Victorine, he was her lover, her husband, her confidant, and I guess her kind of co-laborer in the idea of race, pride, and community uplift. So he comes also from North Carolina, according to Mark Cheshire's book, as another migrant looking for work and kind of bettering oneself. He is very entrepreneuring and very hardworking, but he was also a polymath and self-taught in mathematics. He was really gifted mathematically. So he runs the numbers. He maximizes his opportunity by doing kind of an innovative thing across the city. We would call that the underground economy right now in terms of scholarship, but every ethnic group did that. And so he did the same thing. And they met, well, she was on a date at the time, actually, with some other beau or pursuer, and he was with his guy pals, but they were captivated by each other's beauty. He esteemed her for her education, and she for his thrift.
And there was the added component that Victorine's mother played the numbers. So she had a fondness.
Yes, it was interesting.
For this young man.
She did. The father was rather the holdout. But he eventually becomes an employee at the casino, club casino, and kind of becomes an employee of his future son-in-law. So apparently they solved that issue at some point.
Did Victorine's respectability as a teacher, community leader, sanitize William L. Adams? You use that word.
I believe it did in some regards, at least to the African-American community. Now, I can't speak for everybody, but I know that he was revered up until the most recent time. People who are still alive who remember him getting loans from him to open their businesses or having parents or grandparents who went to him for loans because African-Americans were not really at liberty to have the kind of collateral which to acquire loans to open businesses. So he was a businessman. And there is some level of ruthlessness to business, I suppose, and I'm hearing that from some other individuals. But I think her stature and her church attendance, which was not artificial. There was a documentary done in 2000 where he talks about her being so faithful to her mass attendance at St. Peter's Clavier Church. She was very involved in her church that she really lived her life above reproach. So she did, by sheer proxy and her own integrity, kind of brush him off a bit.
You quote at some length a statement she made in 1971, 4 years after she had been elected to the city council, in which she is essentially defending herself and her husband. Let me quote part of it. Quote, "Whereas I am well known as the wife of Willie Adams, I am better known in my community as a diligent, hardworking civic worker and civic leader in my own right. I want to remind some and inform others that I carved a niche in Baltimore for myself with my teaching techniques by sheer dint of hard work. My husband's encouragement and financial support were not handicaps, but I did the purposing, the planning, and saw to the execution of the many projects. I have paid my dues in Baltimore." Close quote. What prompted that?
I believe by the late 60s, early 70s, he was dogged by the media. And principally, a number of politicians were going to jail, who were his contemporaries as well as his affiliates. So there was also speculation that he too should be going to jail because you can't be in the pigsty and not have pig on you. So as a result, she was also being kind of indicted in terms of her being on the city council, giving him some kinds of licensing to open up various restaurants. I know there was one case in which they wanted to open a fast food place in Mondawmin, Mall, and it was going to be his company, and then she was going to be the one to pass the legislation. But they eventually, Dr. Julian, who was also on the city council, went against it because they didn't want the fast food places in an area that had health challenges. They wanted quality food and quality spaces. So that legislation did eventually die in city council. So she was always kind of being indicted as being kind of co-conspirator with him to kind of get his businesses the licensing and political power he should not be allowed to have. So she wanted to draw a line in the sand and make it clear she was nobody's foil or gangster's mall.
In 1943, Victorine Q. Adams and four other women started the Baltimore chapter of the National Council of Negro Women, NCNW. Why was that significant?
Once again, we have three school teachers and a lawyer. Juanita Mitchell Jackson is another one of the charter members of the NCNW. What the NCNW represents for African American women during that time period is a level of agency. Founded in 1935 by Mary McLeod Bethune, yet another educator, she sought to have the clearinghouse and the lobbying capacity of Negro women and children on behalf of the Negro race. So being in Baltimore, although we're in the Upper South, we're still in a Southern city, and there was a lot of residential restrictions and just open, blatant Jim Crow expressions throughout the city that they were going to fight in an overt fashion. They were going to pull themselves together, be their best selves, and demonstrate for the world what the Negro woman has accomplished on behalf of the community. So organizing themselves to basically galvanize themselves to fight strategically and informationally and through respectability, we're going to do that. And so connecting with women from across the country, they were no longer just going to be Baltimore. They were going to be African-American women worldwide, nationwide, on behalf of the race.
And then just a few years later, 1946, just after World War II, she founded the Colored Women's Democratic Campaign Committee with the motto, "If democracy is worth fighting for, it's worth voting for." What was her goal in that?
This comes in the wake of the idea that politics was very important, and it had been a man's game for the greater part of the 20th century. What Mrs. Bethune does open up is that after World War II, what's going to happen to the gains we've made in terms of employment and success? We didn't want them to kind of go away. So the idea that legislation would now open up what would become the Fair Employment Practice Commission and other ways in which African Americans would be judged on their skill, not on the capacity of who they know or how they apprenticed, this becomes a situation in which now to create the legislation to make the federal government model for private industry what fair practice looks like. So as a result, Baltimore at one time, I understand, had over 1 million residents living here in the city. Of the majority of them were African American. Some of them were well-to-do. They were pre-Civil War free. They were educated. They had churches. They had monetary wealth. So they now needed to match that with political clout to be able to ensure that succeeding generations would have access. Education and housing are the two main prongs of that kind of attack on having access, our children to be educated and to be able to live in clean, safe spaces. So that is why the idea of galvanizing and educating, like teachers do, about the vote, that it's not just election day, is a 365-day awakened consciousness to our rights as citizens.
But most Black residents of Baltimore in the 40s were Republican, the party of Lincoln. Why was Victorine Q. Adams a Democrat?
She called it Democratic in terms of the idea of equity. Her mother was very upset when she left the Republican Party and switched to Democratic affiliation because they had been Lincoln-era Republicans. So the idea was not about the party. It was about the candidate. How would they address our concerns in the community? We're not just voting for a man. We're going to vote for a platform and a candidate that will address our concerns. So that became a very clear effort where they kind of separated themselves from their mother's generation and said, we're no longer just going by party. We want to go by how the candidate will treat our agenda.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. I'm speaking with Morgan State University archivist Ida E. Jones, who's written a biography, Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorine Q. Adams, The Power of the Ballot. When we're back, Victorine Adams' own political career. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about Baltimore civil rights leader Victorine Q. Adams, The Power of the Ballot. That's the biography of the first black woman elected to the Baltimore City Council. She organized networks of African Americans, especially women, before running for public office herself. We're revisiting a conversation from May when I spoke with Adams biographer, Morgan State University archivist Ida E. Jones. I asked what Victorine Adams did in her early 30s when she left the classroom for the business world.
Her husband purchased a store on Pennsylvania Avenue called the Charm Center. I was made to understand an upscale boutique. Once again, because of Jim Crow, African-American women could not shop in spaces that were dominated by white American citizens. So they could not go in there unless they were, quote, buying for their mistress. And if they touched it, it basically was theirs. So the dignity that they would eventually want to have, they'd have to go to New York or Philadelphia to buy clothes. So as a result, with her opening the Charm Center, women of means, as well as working class women, could shop in a level of peace and freedom and try on clothes in a very nice posh location.
My head was already spinning about all the organizations that she founded or was active in, three sororities she belonged to. And then I reached your account of her starting an organization called Woman Power. What was Woman Power?
Now, Woman Power was the next incarnation of the Colored Women's Democratic Campaign Committee. They had moved away from color at this point, and now they were going to galvanize women to run for political office. No longer just teaching you as a citizen how to vote, but now saying, let's start women running as candidates. So Verda Wellcome is going to be one of the first fruits of that tree, because she's going to run for the state Senate and eventually be elected as the first African-American woman in the country to be elected to a state senator position. So what they do with Woman Power is they grow out of Baltimore. They have chapters in Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, and other areas, and grow to the idea of collaborating with white women to say, we as women are oppressed. Let's join our forces together, not against men, but in sanctity for the community, because we're the mothers, we're the caretakers, we're the wives. So as a result, we have a different empathetic way of looking at society. So let's join men who are compassionate politicians, and let's move this conversation to where everyone can benefit as citizens.
In her 50s, Victorine Adams ran for public office unsuccessfully, first for the House of Delegates, then successfully in 1966. And then the very next year, she left the House of Delegates to run for the Baltimore City Council. Why?
Because there were so many black women on the state level. There was nobody in the city. So she has a heart for Baltimore, born and bred. I don't believe she lived anywhere else. She traveled around the world. There's various pictures of her traveling, Greece, Italy, Ireland, what have you. But she stays in the city and she loves the city. I did not realize the kind of terror of the late 1960s. I mean, we see the documentaries and some people have lived through it. But the poverty that was happening in the city as McCormick Spice left, as the shipyards closed, as these kinds of manufacturing and manual jobs left the city, you impoverished a generation of working, able-bodied people who were not transitioning or being transitioned to the new jobs that were coming. So now you're going to criminalize poverty, and people are going to do what? Go to the underground economy to make money. But that's been criminalized, and they have no jobs. So as a result, she was going to come back to the city and help the city retool and retrain people between the ages of, let's say, 18 and 35 at the peak of their working capacity for the jobs that were coming. She really concerned herself with that. And so she really throws herself into the heart of the city, in part because of her Catholic upbringing also, that those who have need to share with those who don't have and be voice and advocate for those who are not voice or advocate for themselves. So she comes back and wants to be that consciousness in the city of Baltimore on behalf of the residents of Baltimore, because the state had Verda Wellcome. The state had other people in place at the state level, but there was no one here in the city.
Victorine Adams served 5 terms on the city council until 1983. What did she do on the council?
She innovated a lot of things. She was really concerned about the idea of retooling and retraining working class people who were losing their jobs. At the same time, she was kind of entangled with the federal government, because there were various presidential administrations who were also kind of in this campaign to criminalize basically people who weren't working. If you were idle, you were basically a criminal or you were a vagabond, so we're going to kind of find ways to restrict your movements. So that was one of her legislative activities, was to create job training, and if persons had lack of education, to really strengthen educational and cognitive skills so they could find places to fit in the new economy. One of her greatest opportunities was the Baltimore Fuel Fund, and that was very interesting, because during the 1970s, people would just lose their fuel because they didn't have the money to pay their bill. So people went to alternative heating sources, and there were several persons that died. And she thought that was just beyond egregious, that someone who owes $500 or $1,000 in a heating utility during the winter, you shut off their heat. So she does this public-private partnership to raise money to pay the bills of individuals who've maxed out their own cash. And I was under the impression from Mary Pat Clark that the amount of money that was basically in arrears was between $500 to $700.
That's Morgan State archivist Ida B. Jones, author of the biography Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorine Q. Adams. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. You have a wonderful chapter about respectability that points out most African-American female leaders didn't stumble into their influence. They had to be quite intentional. Talk about that.
Yes, there is a lot of baggage to just being a woman or being female in American society. So African-American women, because of enslavement, were basically superimposed with an idea of how they were to be and look. And as a result, once emancipation happens, they are now able to redefine themselves in terms of their own self-definition. And once again, Mrs. Bethune, who was born in 1875, having known her grandmother and mother who were enslaved, really takes to heart with what it means to be a woman, how to carry yourself, the idea of being physically presentable in terms of one's hair, one's dress, one's demeanor. So Stephanie Shaw and her work does an excellent job of looking at three generations of black women from the 1870s up until about Victorine's time and how they were basically selected and groomed for the leadership they eventually grow into. So it wasn't just haphazard, but mother and father, community expected of them a certain way to carry themselves. And it's very interesting because even my penmanship, some of the things my mother would make fun of me about, my not knowing phonics or, you know, not having my hair well coiffed. You know, she does that. So I understand now in retrospect what that means. People read you. And as a result, they've already had a preconceived notion. When you confirm that, there's a stereotype. But when you actually can kind of bust or shatter those norms, it's like, wow, she really is different. She's not like those others. So the whole idea is that we all should be allowed to be read as individuals. So that's part of it.
Would you read for us the quotation you have from some written advice that Victorine Adams gave to representatives of the Colored Women's Democratic Campaign Committee?
Yes, with the Colored Women's Democratic Campaign Committee in light of respectability, she says, "Do not overdress, be neat, wear a hat and gloves, no slips showing, please no loud talking, be alert at all times, speak clearly if called upon, give your name and title, make sure to mention Miss or Mrs., registered voter and interested in good government, take a friend with you if you can, the more the merrier, however, only the delegate or alternate will be paid, if you cannot go at the appointed time, let us know, or better still, get a substitute, a lady in the club." So she was very clear on the intentionality of what the CWDCC would be. And I think there's also mention of the idea that she didn't want women taking notes in the meeting, to try to retain as much as possible in your head because notes make them clog their conversation.
Some of that is timeless advice. And some, you'd have to explain to many young women what a slip is that should not be showing.
Exactly. They wear them as dresses. Yeah, that's true. It's huge. Because once again, the idea of who you were perceived as being. And this is an era during which you have African-American women working as domestics. And as a result, you have images on the TV and the radio putting African-Americans in certain servile positions, which was no indication of shame. But it was a superimposed stereotype that limited everybody to a certain kind of spectrum. And that's what they were seeking to shatter.
Very early in the book, describing the spirit of the times that Victorine Quill was born into, you write, quote, "She and others did not view themselves as victims to injustice," close quote. How could they not?
This is a very interesting question. I just had a conversation with a woman in her 70s recently, and she was asked a very similar question. And she says to me, and I think it stands for Victorine, the parents created such a space in the house that was almost euphoric, that you could do anything, literally anything you put your mind to, you can do. So this woman I spoke to recently said to me, she said she was 16 when her father was having this conversation. And she said, "Well, Dad, I can't be president." He goes, "There'll be a day when there will be one, and you need to be ready." So she was so insulated. I believe Victorine, as well as this woman that I was speaking to, were so insulated within their household that this self-esteem and the ideas that we have now, poor self-esteem, never entered it because their parents reinforced in their minds, "You can do anything. You can be anything. Put your mind to it and do it." It's like a superhero. That's the only way I can equate it in modern terms. They were like superheroes.
It's a fascinating book. Congratulations on
this. Thank you so very much.
Ida E. Jones, University Archivist at Morgan State University, is author of Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorine Q. Adams, The Power of the Ballot. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass, so glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!